Hello and welcome to Cruising for Reviews, and the podcast where I get a friend to watch a Tom Cruise movie they've never seen before and then review it with me. I'm your host, Cara Westworth, and I am rejoined by Andrew, who has seen this movie before, but is reviewing it with me anyway because it's my podcast and I can do what I want. Thanks for coming back, Andrew.
No worries. It's also hard to find a Tom Cruise movie that I haven't seen multiple times already. So
yeah, we worked that out really quickly that there was not a lot. And like, I think Endless Love was the only one, and don't watch it. It's like Tom Cruise is in it for 2 seconds and it's like a garbage 80s movie about Brooke Shields having underage sex with a boy. Not a good time. Yeah, we're reviewing War of the Worlds. We started the review last week, which you should probably go listen to because we're going to just kick off where we left off. Just quickly, where we left off was Ray, played by Tom Cruise, has basically said goodbye to his son, let him go fight the aliens or whatever he needs to do. And at this point, it looks like Robbie may have been blown up in an explosion that happened shortly after leaving his dad.
R.I.P. Robbie.
They run off because obviously there's big explosions and everything. Like the Hummer comes down the hill in flames and everything, like a proper war scene kind of situation. There's a man standing from looks like a storm shelter, I guess a basement under a big old house, and he's like calling people over, and Ray and Rachel head towards him to seek shelter with this man who's offering his home or whatever it is to people who are running past. This is where we meet the character played by Tim Robbins, Harlan Ogilvie, I think you pronounce it. He is an amalgamation of a few characters apparently from the War of the Worlds, the original story. Yes. Set up straight away that he's a bit of a crazy guy. Ray puts his daughter to sleep. There's a really sweet moment where he sings Rachel to sleep. Doesn't know any nursery rhymes or lullabies. He sings. Actually, do you know what the song is that he sings?
Oh, he sings. What is it? My little deuce coop.
Yeah, that's it. He doesn't know any lullabies, so he sings.
That is the Beach Boys song, Little Deuce Coop.
Beach Boys.
It's the only thing he can think to sing. but like we said, by this point, he's just doing whatever he can.
Yeah, just trying his best with the very limited resources he has. Yeah, so Harlan, after he sees them, the little lullaby moment, he goes, here's some peach schnapps. Let's have a chat. And starts sort of waffling on, not conspiracy theories, because it kind of sounds like it, but he's actually offering, I guess, very harsh truths about what's happening with this whole alien invasion that, Ray probably doesn't want to think about right now. And also, there's a sleeping child there. Not really super ideal, but, once Harlan gets going, he gets going.
He definitely has, like prepper vibes, doesn't he?
Yes. And I don't think it's even his house. I think it's just some place he found and is like, no, this is a good place. And says to Ray, I didn't ask you to come in here because I wanted you to feel safe. I came here because I need someone to help me fight the aliens. We're going to bash them up, which Ray's just left someone who wanted to go bash up the aliens and now has this complete stranger ranting and raving about it that he has to deal with his traumatized daughter.
I feel like also at this point, I'm trying to remember if we've seen examples of people attempting to fight, because they're sort of hearing things on radios of soldiers and stuff like that saying hey, nothing we do is doing anything. And then you see fighter jets flying over towards them, and that doesn't seem to do anything before all the flaming Humvees come rolling back over the hill. So I feel like Ray is kind of already in a position where he's I've seen what these things are doing to people and to the military and everything else.
Yeah, if the military with big jets can't do it. And I think they show that when the birds are flying around, especially, that there's shields around them, so no matter what they do, these alien crafts have shields around them, so you can't penetrate them anyway. So what does old mate Harlan think he's going to do with his shotgun? They show that there are these weird red vines creeping in through the window that look like veins kind of thing, which is horrific. Harlan is still ranting and raving as the tripods go quiet, and Ray's shut the fuck up, something's happening. And I can only, the way I think to describe it is some sort of tentacle, but it's got lights and an eye or a camera on the end. It's kind of one of those, what do you call those things that you use, doctors use to go to do colonoscopies and stuff?
Oh, like the scopes.
Yeah.
Or like the things that SWAT teams use, where it's a long
Oh, yeah.
A long sort of, like prehensile camera kind of thing that they can steer around. It's a bit like that.
Yeah. So the aliens send one of those in to have a squiz at what's going on in the basement. And, you know, they quietly sort of creep around trying to avoid it. At one point, Harlan picks up an axe and is like pretty keen on smashing it. And Ray's like quietly like no, don't. And manages to convince him. Like Harlan's like, okay. And then he stops and decides not to chop it, which is probably a good idea because it's like what, like a telephone pole kind of thickness? Like,
yeah.
It's not like a little finger width thing that they can just smash through. So the only problem is though, when after he decides not to smash it with an axe, he still manages to crash into a wall covered in like noisy things. So the camera like whips around and they manage to get away from it by putting like this beautiful mirror, which I don't understand why it was in the basement. Like I would spend a lot of money having that in there in my house for really good selfies. But yeah, they use this big mirror and they hide behind it. So the camera tentacle thing is kind of a little bit confused by it. Her foot slips out behind it. But when it goes around to have a look, they've just left a shoe there. So it's a distraction.
Very crafty move.
Yes.
Yeah. So they get to the end of this and it's very tense as they're attempting to kind of evade this thing that's looking around for them. And then it finally kind of retracts itself from the room and they're all very relieved until they hear something else, which it turns out to be aliens coming in. They have a little poke around, have a little investigate.
Like, and I actually find them very cute because I think they got big eyes, so that's kind of cute. But also like they're very curious in like touching things, like picking up photos and looking at them and sharing them. And like they're interested in the wheel because apparently in the original War of the Worlds, those aliens didn't have wheels. So yeah, they were really curious by a bike wheel that they're playing with and everything. So yeah, I thought these aliens in this moment were quite cute.
Oh yeah, they're just poking around. They're just checking out what's going on. And I think as well, like you could definitely sort of make the case for them as, I don't know, like look at what humans have done to populations of animals and other humans in like colonizing parts of the world. So, you know, you could look at what the aliens are doing as like, oh, we're just clearing out this nest of ants in this place that we wanna come and relax in. And then they get out and they're curious and they're looking around and checking everything out.
Just like, well, you know, they've inherited this new planet. They're like, well, we better go suss out what they've left us and what we can do with the scraps.
Yeah, and they don't seem like incredibly like villainous by nature in this moment, I guess.
Yeah, that's what I was saying to Ben. Like, I wonder how many people watch movies like this and don't see the parallels for like colonization on our own planet. Like people just like, oh, those fucking aliens. And like, yeah, and yet like Australians living in Australia, very similar. Harlan goes to shoot one of the aliens, which again, not
very
a good
helpfully.
Idea. Yeah, nothing. Yeah. You shoot one alien and then you're killed by all the other aliens there. Ray like silently starts wrestling. So there's like really silent wrestling match trying to get the gun off him. He manages to get the gun off Ray and then the horn sound goes off and the aliens are like, oh, okay, back to it. It's kind of like they were on a break and they got to go down and have a sticky beak and then they're like, okay, go back to the ships. We're going to keep fucking shit up.
It's like the whistle at the factory in the Flintstones.
Yeah. Exactly. Oh,
back to it.
So they disappear and Helen's like, I don't think we're on the same page here. I'm like, oh, you fucking think, do you? You don't think Ray wants to like fight the aliens with his 10-year-old daughter sleeping in the next room? Harlan absolutely goes nuts. So they look out the window and see a man being taken down from one of the tripods and you don't see it very explicitly, but basically they have this weird needly pronged thing that goes and like sucks up his blood by the looks of it and yeah, it kills him and Harlan absolutely fucking flips out at this point. I mean, I don't know what he thought was happening to the humans, but yeah, flips out and he goes and he starts digging a hole, like some in the basement, like he wants to build, he's ranting about building tunnels and like underground subway system and we're gonna be safe humans, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, Ray just kind of like goes, okay, goes and blindfolds Rachel and says, whatever you hear, whatever, just don't take your blindfold off. Starts singing that lullaby you told me about earlier and goes and kills Harlan. Basically, yeah, not much else you can do at this point.
I feel like there's several moments of like very prominent blindfold imagery in this movie and in Minority Report.
Mm.
There's the whole part in Minority Report where he has his eyes swapped out, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a kind of a whole thing during that movie. But also in this, yeah, there's, I think there's like, there's the earlier moments where he's blindfolding her to try and protect her from this entire thing.
Yeah.
Which like we said, is very, very futile and just sort of wasted effort and isn't actually doing anything to protect his child. And then there's this moment where he's blindfolding her to say, to save her from like the worst thing that he has to do to keep her safe. Because this is the point of like the, like a lot of movies have, I guess, different kinds of like power fantasies and revenge fantasies and stuff like that about, you know, what would you do for your family and what would you do to protect your children? And there's entire genres of movies like Death Wish and Taken and stuff that are like, how many other adults would you murder to to protect your child or avenge a sexual assault? You know, in all of those situations, it never actually involves anything happening to the male character. It's all him being very upset on somebody else's behalf. But yeah, this is like a much more kind of harrowing version of, this is the point where he's like, this is what I'm going to have to do to keep my daughter safe. And so it's not him trying to shield her from everything bad that's happening in the world. It's him trying to shield her from the absolute worst thing that he's going to have to do in order to keep her safe.
I mean, all the stuff that she's seen is traumatic enough, yet seeing her dad have to kill a man to keep her alive is, yeah, that's a lot. Like after the deed, he comes and like hugs her on the couch. And I think she must, I feel like she must know, like, I don't know. She's 10 years old. She's not a toddler. She must know something's happened to the other guy for him to suddenly to be quiet when he's been ranting and raving this whole time. But like, it's a nice moment where they just kind of hug and he's covered in blood. And yeah, just they kind of hug and go, okay, let's just go to sleep now. See how we go.
Well, and that it's obviously like a harrowing thing for him as well.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's not clearly a...
Yeah, he's not the kind of guy who's like, cool, I got to kill someone. He's like, well, that was the most fucked thing I've ever done in my whole life.
Yeah, it's obviously both very traumatic and like an absolute last resort scenario for him. You know.
Yeah. I mean, Harlan proved pretty intensely that he was either going to get them killed by upsetting the aliens constantly, or he was so far into his like mania that he was going to hurt them because they weren't willing to save human race like he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So they fall asleep on the couch. Rachel is woken by, Mr. Eye Tentacle comes back. Don't know why they keep coming back to the, like, are they doing this to all the houses they come across, or
I feel like, isn't there like a moment before this where Ray wakes up in the morning and he goes and looks out the window, like he sees those vines? Oh, no. So she gets woken up because she sort of wakes up and is looking around, and then the eye tentacle thing is back and it goes at her. And Ray grabs the axe and finds that you actually can chop into the big monitoring tentacle thing. And so in all the commotion, it snatches up Rachel and he runs outside.
She runs away. So she's like, he's chopping and she's screaming. So she runs upstairs to get away from it all. And which annoying, because he like goes up and looks up the stairs and he's like, opens the front door, but it's all blocked by like lots and lots of the creepy vein things, and goes out. So I'm like, isn't she in the house? But she's obviously run out because he hears a scream from outside. He goes out and he can see all the tentacles are just everywhere. And I don't know if it's a conclusion that you're meant to come to, but I think they're terraforming, because I was like, is that the byproduct of what they're doing to humans? Or
so for me, what I've taken it as is like, so there's the scene earlier that they witness, which is somebody getting picked up by a tripod and, you know, having all their insides sucked out. It then looks like they're basically like spraying this all over the place. And whatever they're doing in the, that's sort of causing all of these big creepy vein-like vines to grow everywhere, it very much seems like they're using like blood or like biological material sucked out of humans as that part of the terraforming or like farming process, which I think adds a layer to like the colonization sort of theme of, yeah, the way you come in and colonize something is with the blood of the people who were there before. Like, they are literally sowing the ground with the blood of the people that they've killed to take the land.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's such a creepy scene when he comes out of the house and there's all like the vines everywhere, and there's what looks like, you know, like a little dam or something, you know, just a pond.
That looks like it's full of red blood.
Yeah, that just looks like it's completely full of blood. It's
like dead livestock and everything lying around as well. Like, yeah, everything's just like, everything's death and then covered in another layer of death.
Yeah.
Rachel ends up getting, so he sees Rachel Rachel's standing there. He runs to get her, but she is scooped up by one of the tendrils who carries her up and puts her into this weird little basket thing that the tripod has at the back of him, which is kind of cute. They have little baskets to put his humans in.
Yep, little cargo cage.
Ray is like, over my dead body. So he goes and finds like outside like some sort of army vehicle, like a belt full of ammunition and grenades, and grabs it and uses it, one of the grenades, chucks it to get the attention of the tripod, like the equivalent of like chucking rocks at like a bear to get its attention.
Yep.
Kind of thing. It turns around and picks him up and puts him in the basket, which is full of other terrified human beings who have obviously been going to be harvested.
It's lucky that it did choose to pick him up as opposed to instantly vaporizing him.
Yeah, I know, right? So.
Although you also kind of get the sense at this point that the aliens have like the initial wave of them coming out and just blasting everybody is the sort of initial invasion. But by this point, they've kind of established that these things aren't really a threat.
Yeah.
And now they're at the point of like, oh, okay, we've had that initial wave and established that there isn't any real resistance. And so now we're just going around scooping them all up as resources.
So yeah, scoops him up. There were someone else in the basket gets picked up. A tendril comes out of what can only be described as what looks like a sphincter and picks him up and sucks him up through there, obviously to do some gross stuff with. But then I'm also like, when they picked up that guy and put him on the ground and then sucked him out, I'm like, maybe they just do a bit of both. They do some on the ground, they do some mm-hmm. up in the sphincter. Who knows?
All I know is I don't want to go up into the sphincter.
No, like even if it's a nice time up there, I don't want to have to go by those means if I can avoid it. Another tendril comes down to grab, and it sort of aims itself at Rachel. So Ray obviously blocks her. So it picks him up by the legs and starts dragging him up. And this other soldier who I guess sees, oh, that's a father and daughter. Like we should probably help this guy not get sucked up in there. And they start pulling him down, and everyone sort of joins in and is pulling him down. And he gets almost all the way sucked up, but they manage to sort of pull him down at the last minute and comes out. He doesn't come out covered in slime, which I think is nice.
Disappointing.
I'm like, usually that's the case. Like you come out of a thing, a monster, and you're just covered in disgusting slime, but it's a dry sphincter, which is, I guess, nice. But he spits out, and he's one of my favorite, not very common, but my favorite Tom Cruise-isms is he spits out all these grenade pins. And yeah, he's managed to set off a bunch of grenades. Like the soldier's like, oh, everyone get down. And he blows up the tripod from within by setting off a bunch of grenades up in that butthole up there.
I feel like this is the first point as well in the movie where we actually see some people working together.
Yeah.
Because like up until this point, it's just been everybody panicking.
Because yeah, even when the first guy gets sucked up there, everyone just lets him get sucked up. But this is the first time, yeah, one guy goes, oh no, I'm going to help this guy not get sucked up. And yeah.
Even Ray, who's like the hero of the movie up to this point, has been very looking out for himself and his family. Mm. You know, the acts like Robbie trying to help people are still quite isolated incidents. We haven't really seen any instances so far of anybody actually sort of banding together to try and help each other.
Yeah. So they get knocked down, like the basket gets knocked down, and they're alive and safe, and they've killed that tripod. I guess they just, at this point, they're just walking back into a city, which turns out it must be Chicago. Or I don't know if more time has passed. I'm not sure.
Oh, they're trying to get into Boston still, aren't they, at this point?
Oh, is it Boston?
Because that's where the mother is, so they're still heading in that direction.
Oh, yes, Boston. For some reason, I thought it was Chicago. Are they near each other? I actually don't know.
I don't know either. Hmm. Definitely on that side of the country.
They're up there. And there's a big cluster of them up there somewhere. As they're walking into the city, they can see all the red veins covering everything. They're all kind of turning gray. And when Ray picks one up, it's all like turns into dust in his hands, which is one of the things where I'm like, is it human material turned to dust? Or is it? So I'm wondering if they suck it up, the human material, and they spit it out with their own biological material. And that's why it dies. Like, because if it was just human material.
I'm assuming that it's related to the ending. Yeah,
yeah.
That it's that stuff is starting to not work for them.
Yeah. Ray like asks the soldier what's going on. Were you able to attack them? And like, no, we haven't. Like, it's they're doing it themselves. They're all sort of starting to collapse and die. And as they're watching,
acting weird.
And some birds start attacking one. And Ray's like, look, there's no shield. Like, fucking bomb them. And they're like, wow, let's do it. And they start blowing them up, and they can actually get through because there's no more shields on these tripods. pods so they can actually start blowing them up. And yeah, they start shooting them down. So yeah, something has happened to make the tripods no longer... I'm wondering if there must have been a time lapse, time lost of them traveling further to Boston, because that happens really quickly. Like everything was doing so well for these tripods and then all of a sudden everything's turned to dust and yeah.
I sort of get the sense that it's supposed to have taken place over like several days.
Oh yeah?
Basically. Like that this has all happened.
Because when I watch it, I'm like, this happens in 2 days.
Yeah, like the in between them sort of... Because there's only... There's only like 2 nights?
Mm.
They have the first night. They have the first night in the mother's house.
Yep.
And then they have the night in, what's his name? Harlan's house. And yeah, so I feel like it's meant to take place across like sort of 3 days.
Yeah. Mm.
So it really doesn't take very long between, you know, the invasion happening. Lots of people getting wiped out. Total kind of takeover by the aliens. The terraforming starts happening. But then also everything starts falling apart immediately.
All right. So it's not just me then. That's good. Because I'm like, have I lost track of all these days? But maybe. But then I'm also just trying to work out, like, how long does it take to get from here to here? But I also thought it was going to Chicago. So it doesn't matter. Yeah. So they get into Boston and they walk down the street to this beautiful part of Boston that doesn't seem super fucked up compared to like New York and everything. But they manage to track down Marianne and the family, her parents, her partner, and in this really like cliche moment where Robbie steps out of the house and he's safe. He didn't die in an explosion and somehow beat them back to...
I feel like it's quite well done in that it's very ambiguous at first where the mum comes out and sees them and she doesn't kind of do any big immediate outward emotional expression. So you could certainly take it as like her seeing that Robbie's not with them.
Yeah.
And having the realization. So it's all kind of neutral for a second, you know, and Ray's having that moment of like, you know, I've completely failed because my one job was to look after the kids. And, you know, now I have to come back here missing, you know, half of them.
Yeah.
I have to come back missing half of the kids and, you know, explain to you what happened and how I lost one of them. But then, yeah, she sort of doesn't do anything external to show either. Oh, don't worry, Robbie's in the kitchen. It's fine.
Yeah.
That would kind of suckle the air out of the scene, you know.
Yeah. Ray and Robbie embrace and, you know, it's kind of like, Dad, you did your best and now I've reflected on it. Maybe I was a bit of an asshole doing that to you.
I probably shouldn't have done that.
I wonder how quickly he realized how bad of it. Probably that big explosion, then he runs back and like they're gone and he's like, oh, Mamma Mia.
Yeah, I'm out.
Yeah, happy moment. Everyone's reunited. And a brief moment back with that narrator that we had at the start of the movie explaining that, in case you hadn't worked it out already, that microorganisms killed aliens from within. Basically, they were killed by the human cold.
Got them.
Like humans, you know, we have a right to be where we are because we've gotten used to all the bugs and the microorganisms and bacteria and everything. But these aliens watching us from afar were like, oh, we can fuck them up. Not knowing that tiny little bugs and a drop of water could actually fuck them up as well.
I like the way it's phrased in that little epilogue. It's like, how do they put it? They say like, you know, humanity's earned the right.
Yeah.
But they say like they've earned it by virtue of like, you know, millions of people who've died or like billions
just
of people who've
out.
Died over millennia because yeah, that is like the process of developing immunity to all of these things over thousands of years is people dying from them, you know?
Lots of people dying.
Collectively, so I guess it's like interesting conceptually as like that's a cost that you have paid like as a species in a war with all of the bacteria and microbes and stuff that are on your own planet that has gone on between you and them for years and years and years. You know, you think about things like how like in hospitals, you know, constantly like disinfecting everything and winds up leading to like superbugs in hospitals and like heaps people all taking like antibiotics too much means that they stop being as effective against all these different things. So, you know, we are like, I've read these things where they're talking about like immunologists and stuff being concerned that we are like constantly kind of on the brink of fucking it up and just not being immune to a whole bunch of stuff anymore through like overprescription of antibiotics, all that kind of stuff.
Which is poignant considering, you know, what's going on in the world at the moment.
Absolutely. Yeah, this was an ending that I think a lot of people didn't did not care for, because, you know, it is adapted directly from the original, I believe. But yeah, I can imagine a lot of people being kind of not particularly impressed by it, because it, you know, it's this huge special effects extravaganza, and they get to the end and they go, and the aliens died.
I mean, the problem I have, and this, the ending, apart from, I mean, I think it wraps up a bit too neatly, kind of, like, it's like, there we go. It was just the organisms that did it after all. Like, yeah, it happens really quickly. But the thing that I think that pisses a lot of people off as well is that Robbie shouldn't have survived. Like, it's not great storytelling, I guess. Like, Ray had to let his son go, like, as his, like, big lesson learned and everything. Or that we shouldn't, you know, maybe we don't have to know what happened to Robbie. We can just, for him to have not only survived but beat them back, kind of weakens the moral of why, you know, what was the significance of thinking his son had died if it was just to be undone, you know, 10 minutes later.
I mean, maybe the significance, you know, if they're carrying through that whole plot theme the whole time of being willing to let your kids go and make their own decisions and make their own mistakes and everything, is that he let his son go and he went out and took a risk and he was okay.
Yeah, that's true.
And also, I guess, like, not knowing what happened to Robbie is also kind of a reflection of Robbie did go and have his own journey, you know. He did go and have, like, his own autonomous life for a little stretch there, where his dad wasn't there and his dad wasn't controlling it or, you know, trying to keep him safe or anything. I mean, I kind of think, like, the way that it plays out and wraps up and everything, this movie, like, in a sci-fi way, I think follows a lot of the conventions of, like, disaster movies, where the characters in a disaster movie, the overwhelming majority of the time, can't actually exercise any control over the thing that's happening. They can't be like, ah, I'm going to do X and stop this earthquake that's happening, you know. Oh, I'm going to plug in this thing and stop the volcano or whatever. Which, you know, may even be part of the reason that I don't like some types of, like, disaster movies and that sort of thing that much, because the role of the characters is often very passive. And in this movie, this kind of has the same thing, which is this movie is just the story of a family during this thing that is happening. It's just a few days in the life of this family as this wild, unbelievable thing is occurring around them. They can't really do much personally to change the course of what's happening. And I would argue that a lot of the themes in the movie are about not having any control over what's happening, you know.
Yes, definitely.
However, there are definitely points, like Ray shoving grenades up the tripod sphincter and him being the one to point out to the soldiers that the tripod doesn't have shields. There's just a few points like that where it's like, you kind of, they sort of had to give Ray something to do to be just a little more of a hero or a little more of an active participant in the story than he would have otherwise been if those things just kind of happened anyway.
Yeah.
Which I think is probably, you know, a bit of more of a decision about, like, how do we make sure that our main characters are staying involved in the progression of the story. But those are kind of the only points where I'm like, oh, what, did Ray have to be the one person to be like, hey, do you guys notice this? This thing? Whoa. Thank
you.
Well,
I guess normally in, and thank you, normal civilian walking past at this exact right time. I think with a lot of disaster movies, though, the lead actor usually is the scientist who knows the thing that will potentially help, like, or, you know, I'm just trying to think of, like, in context of, like, Independence Day, where, yeah, it was the computer scientist, Jeff Goldblum, and the grunt soldier who, yeah, there's usually people, but, yeah, Ray doesn't have any special skills or, you know, qualifications that actually will help him in this thing. It's just like him just wandering around trying to do his best, make sure his kids don't die.
Yeah, and he also has just as little or less of an idea of what's happening than anybody else who's walking around.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah, the other difference with a lot of disaster movies, like you're saying, is that there's normally someone who has something to do, or they are, like, you know, a bit of a hero or something. Yeah, often it's somebody who takes the kind of leadership role of saying, I'm going to help us all get out of here, or I'm going to assemble this cast of characters and, like, help get us away from the volcano or get us out of this tunnel or whatever it might be. I keep thinking of the Sylvester Stallone movie Daylight.
About that movie constantly, because every time I'm in a tunnel, like, what would I do in this situation? I'm like, well, I've watched Daylight, so I know what I would do.
That's it. You'll be fine.
That or Independence Day in the tunnel. I think about those two movies all the time. Every time I drive through one of Brisbane's many tunnels.
Yeah, like definitely in those types of movies, normally they find a reason to say like, or like San Andreas, some terrible movie I watched recently with The Rock.
That was filmed near my mum's house, some of that stuff.
There you go.
In Ipswich, yeah.
Yeah, and where it's just like, hey, now we're following this guy who happens to be a highly qualified ex-special forces or, you know, ex-rescue operations guy or something, as opposed to this guy's a longshoreman.
Yeah.
And he has no idea what's happening and he's not very good at being a dad.
If anyone else had directed this, so if it's not been a Spielberg movie, I think there would have been a scene where Ray saves the day by controlling a crane to smash through or do something. Like if it had been a normal kind of disaster movie that wasn't Spielbergian, I think they probably would have used his skill that they set up at the start to be like,
yep.
Oh, who knows how to operate a crane this big? And he's like, oh, it's me. And then he saves the day by, I don't know, dropping a container on a tripod or something. But it's a Spielberg movie, so we did not get that.
Yeah, I think in this movie, it's kind of, for me, it's kind of like a good sweet spot, like a good intersection in Spielberg stuff between family focused, slightly more believable as humans, characters and really big budget special effects, sci-fi kind of thing, you know, because like Minority Report, much more, you know, he's an extremely capable, like he's a cop, he's also the smartest cop and better at the job than everybody else and all those sorts of things, you know, and very sort of physically capable and all that sort of stuff in a sci-fi setting. But in this, yeah, he's just really just supposed to be a very ordinary guy. And there's not too many moments in the movie where he does anything that's kind of exceptional, you know, either physically or, yeah, he's other than the one moment where he's just kind of done whatever he can to save his daughter by getting up in the alien. That's really the only thing that he's done that is like kind of action hero-ish in the movie. Everything else is kind of running away from stuff and hiding under things and...
Yeah, acting like a normal person.
Yeah, holding his daughter and running away from stuff is a lot of the movie. And like I said, I love this movie for the pacing. I think it is an immaculately paced movie. Because when you think about this movie, I think you just think about any of the number of like set pieces, you know. There is a plane crashing on us. We're in a basement and Tim Robbins is going insane.
Although they're zooming away at the start and the bridge is like just getting absolutely destroyed around behind them and like flipping trucks and cars at them.
Yep, people getting, all the people getting, you know, vaporized on the street and turned into ash. And even, yeah, so you think of all of these set pieces and it's a very, very like, to me, it's a very propulsive movie. Like everything is constantly kind of getting pushed forward. There's pretty much always a sense in any given scene that they can't really be in the place that they're in for very long. That for one reason or another, whether it's an external factor, they have to keep moving or they immediately find that they're unsafe in the place that they're in. So like it keeps moving forward really briskly all the time. And between all of those set pieces, there's just no filler, you know?
Yeah.
There's nothing in this movie that is just kind of like, hey, we're just kind of padding out 10 minutes of dialogue or something here, you know? Everything kind of happens as part of one of the scenes. A lot of that sort of character work happens in those big set pieces and everything. And even then, like, I think even the sort of, a lot of the connective tissue between those set pieces is those very small moments of quiet where you do get the character development.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's very fluid. I think how the movie just kicks along at a very brisk pace the whole time.
Definitely. Yeah, it's one of my favorite things too. Like, there's not a moment where you're like, oh, what's going to happen next? It's just like, fuck yeah, everything's happening is so full on and amazing and scary and what would I do in this situation? And yeah, it is an excellent movie. So obviously you love this movie and rate this really highly. Is there anything you don't like about the movie?
No, I think, like I was saying, I think it's only those kind of moments where it's like, you know, why is Ray the guy to notice that the shields are down? I think it's very well done the way that they move from like, okay, here's our house, here's us seeing the alien come out, here's us running away and everything. But in all of the scenes, it feels like it's Rey who notices everything.
Yes.
It's Rey who sort of sees things happening first. It's Rey that notices that, like, the ground is cold. Everybody around him, like, all the people in the neighborhood who all know each other. Yeah. Are like, what do you think, Rey? So like I said, I think there's a few points where it's like, you could have just let this thing happen and just had Rey be there to see it instead of him necessarily needing to be the kind of driving force in some of the areas. But, you know, outside of that, I mean, like we were saying at the very beginning of the last episode, it's pretty rare to see Tom Cruise play like a family sort of role, to play a father. I'm trying to think of roles outside of things like, you know, I think him and Nicole Kidman's characters have kids in like Eyes Wide Shut. I don't know if you ever see them.
You just like briefly see them like one bit in their bedroom. Yeah. Not just like a schlubby guy, but he's also like a proper family guy. I'd have to actually go through and look, because now that you've said that, I actually can't think of.
Yeah, I really struggle to think of like any movie of his where his character like has kids. He doesn't have kids.
I mean, in Minority Report, he had a kid, but we don't get to see the kid.
That's true.
Outside of flashbacks and things.
Yeah, and so you don't have to actually see him like having a family and other than flashbacks where everything's kind of happy.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, outside of that, I kind of look across his whole filmography and I feel like this is the only one, really. I'm scanning the whole thing right now. American Made, he has kids, but at the same time, it's just like you see them in a couple of scenes.
It's not about really him being a family man, it's about him being a plain man.
Yeah, his the thing that he is doing in that movie is something entirely separate from that, and the family stuff is always, it's a background note in that movie.
Yeah.
This is really the only thing in his whole filmography where not only, like you said, is he meant to be kind of just working class and normal, he's also meant to be not that great of a guy. He is not specially qualified or skilled or trained in any way, and he also has to look after his kids the whole time. So it's very, very unique Tom Cruise role in that sense.
It really is. Yeah, he's not the hero really in any kind of normal Tom Cruise-y way. Like, yeah, and he does it so well that I kind of wish he would do a role like this sort of regular guy with a family kind of thrust into a situation where he has to try and be a hero. Like, I'm just thinking, like, I just watched True Lies and just thinking, like, Arnold Schwarzenegger has done that a bit where has been just like a normal family guy who gets, you know, he might have a past, like, actually Commando is what I watched recently, where, you know, he has a past and everything, but like, he's a family guy just trying to enjoy his family and then doing it. But yet you would think Tom Cruise would be better suited to those because he doesn't look like Arnold Schwarzenegger, like the big action hero. But yeah, no, Tom Cruise just hasn't really done it. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, and like, you know, I mean, you can definitely kind of, I think you can kind of divide his filmography pretty neatly into like pre and post like blockbuster kind of career, you know. And a lot of the things that he was doing before, he was doing much more of the kind of Mission Impossibles and Minority Report and The Last Samurai and that kind of stuff. A lot of those sorts of things, like, you know, Cocktail and Rain Man and The Color of Money and stuff. I really like those movies because he's just playing a character. He's not playing like a superhuman guy or anything. He's just playing a guy, and often one who can be like quite unlikable in his own way. Like, you know, his character in Rain Man is not a nice guy.
I remember yelling at that guy a lot.
But how much more interesting does that make the movie, you know?
Yeah.
that he is someone like with his own set of motivations, that he's like, he's selfishly motivated for the overwhelming majority of that movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, like a lot of those sort of earlier pieces where it's just much more of like a character piece, like Risky Business, you know, things where he is a normal person.
Yeah.
Granted, in the case of those things, he is a normal, like, 20-year-old or 25-year-old doing
stuff. I'm wondering, like, because when he was younger, he did all these more, like, up until, like, I feel like Jerry Maguire and Vanilla Sky, he was still doing kind of those sorts of roles. And then he's gotten to a point where he's doing all these blockbusters. Do you think he's just trying to, like, before he gets too old to do all this stuff, he's just like, I really like doing this stuff. I'm going to smash it out and then I'll have, you know, 20 years. I can do more easier roles.
I would imagine so. I think so. Like, I mean, it definitely seems like whenever I see any kind of behind the scenes stuff with him now, like from, you know, the most recent Mission Impossible, or I was showing my dad the behind the scenes stuff from the new Top Gun movie, because I was like, hey, I will probably watch this, not because I care about Top Gun, but so my dad was in the Air Force as like an engineer, and he worked on like fighter jets, like repairing fighter jets and that sort of stuff. So he was very into fighter jets for a long time. And I was like, yeah, check this out. They seem to just be flying fighter jets for this whole movie and actually filming it, you know, because it seems like Tom Cruise is bankable enough as a movie star and, you know, does everything through his own production company so he can insure himself for death in a fighter jet or whatever, you know.
Clinging onto a side of a plane for a stunt.
Yep. It seems like he gradually transitioned from, I'll learn a stunt if it's required, to, I want to learn this thing, so I will build a movie around it.
Well, they're going to go into space soon. So, like, that seems to be just built around Tom Cruise, like, I want to go to space. And, like, well, we can make that into a movie.
Yep. We'll be the first people to film some action blockbuster stuff in space.
So, don't worry. I'll be there rattling the doors at the cinemas when that comes out.
Oh, like, I definitely kind of look at it as far as, you know, it just in that manner of, like, hey, nice work if you can get it. If, if you can get paid a whole bunch of money and make work for a bunch of other people so that you can go out and just do whatever absolutely wild shit you want. If you want to strap you to the side of a literal cargo plane and take off, all that sort of stuff, just so you can say, I reckon I can do that. Let's do it now. It's got to be one of the, you know, more fun existences.
Yeah, like, why wouldn't you? If you want to do that and you have the ability to, why wouldn't you?
Well, there would be, I feel like there would be very few people in the world who would be in a position to be able to do it. And he seems to be taking full advantage of it. So more
power
to him.
Living his best life.
That's right.
Before we go on to Tom Cruise-isms, may I ask, as a Tom Cruise mega fan, what is your favorite Tom Cruise movie?
Ooh. Really hard. I feel like this is terrible, but I feel like the Tom Cruise movie that I have probably watched the most is Jack Reacher.
Really?
Yeah.
Because they're probably my least favorite Tom Cruise movies.
It's I don't like the second one as much, but the first one just scratches something in my brain just right. But I think as far as like my favorite ones, I probably couldn't pick one. I'll throw a few out. I'd probably say like War of the Worlds and maybe Risky Business. I think Risky Business is one of the best soundtracks.
And it's such a, like, I try and explain this to people all the time. What you think Risky Business is, if you've never seen it, it's probably not that. Like, it's such a different movie to how they kind of sold it and how people think about it.
It's much more like a very adult Ferris Bueller, you know?
Mm.
But yeah, great movie. Got Bronson Pinchot in it. Like, I think generally the stuff from the first kind of third of his career, I think he's just a very captivating performer in things like Rain Man and Cocktail, Color of Money, Risky Business, all those things. Like, yeah, he's just gives very kind of, I don't know, electric performances in those things. So I would say that little stretch of movies, I think, might be my favorite.
Nice. For some reason, I'm just really into spy movies, and I didn't realize that until I became obsessed with Tom Cruise, because I love Mission Impossible. And then outside of Mission Impossible, I'm obsessed with Night and Day.
I haven't seen that one.
Oh my God.
One of the few that I have not seen.
It rules. He and Cameron Diaz have so much chemistry, you wouldn't believe it. And he's playing, basically, it's like a funny spy movie. Like, it's a bit more silly than Mission Impossible. And it's also Tom Cruise at his handsomest, which is another reason why I enjoy it. Yeah, I really like that. And otherwise, I think Edge of Tomorrow is probably my other favorite Tom Cruise movie.
Such a good movie.
Jesus Christ, that's a good movie.
I just think, like, late career, like to me, the two best stretches of his career are that first however many years where he's doing like Risky Business and Cocktail and everything, and playing like, you know, just really interesting characters. And then there is the late career sci-fi Tom Cruise.
Yeah, so good.
That I think is just a great, great reinvention. You know, Edge of Tomorrow absolutely rules. Like, War of the Worlds and Minority Report rule.
Oblivion?
Oblivion is cool. I know a lot of people give Oblivion a bad rap.
I find that very fun. Yeah. Okay. Well, now we've gone off track for a while there. That's fine. I love talking about Tom Cruise. People who like Tom Cruise and don't want to be mean to him all the time. We'll talk about Tom Cruise-isms quickly. Obviously, stunts. If you watch any of the making ofs or behind the scenes of this movie, Tom Cruise does, he does all his own stunts. Anyway, there's not a lot of stunts, I think, as compared to, say, Minority Report, where, you know, he's not clinging onto someone with a jetpack and falling down through scaffolding, like those sort of stunts. It's mostly just him reacting and running away. And yeah, he doesn't get batted around that much, except for like when they're, you know, confronting the tripod who's kidnapped his daughter kind of thing. But
yep,
any stunts that are in the movie, obviously he did them all. Running, a lot of running at the start of the movie, and a combination of super Tom Cruise-y running when he's bolting away from the explosions, and then the more reacting and it's scared of shitting himself kind of running that we don't see as much, but yeah, it's still a Tom Cruise thing. What's another Tom Cruise-ism? It's only in a couple of movies, Edge of Tomorrow and maybe one other, where he sneaks some grenades somewhere and then spits out, you know, reveals in his hand that there's grenade pins. I call that a Tom Cruise-ism. What else? Does he do the Tom Cruise kind of like over the top, like laugh, clap kind of? I'm just trying to think.
Not a lot of joy gets expressed in this movie.
There's no time. Yeah, there's no, like, the thing that happens in a surprising amount of Tom Cruise movies as well is him getting drunk and having like a bit of a monologue. Doesn't get a chance to do that. Doesn't monologue at all in this movie.
No. Although I feel like maybe that bit at the start where he's like telling the kids to get all their stuff and, you know, get all the food and put it in a box and stuff like that. A bit of that kind of very quick clipped speaking to everybody, you know, a really short way of speaking that he has.
Apart from that, as per usual, never remember what Tom Cruise-isms I'm meant to cover. That's fine. Like I said, it's my podcast. Do what I want. All right. So we better review the movie now before we talk forever about how much we love Tom Cruise. So my review is, I'm going to give it 4 schlubby rays falling over a plastic chair frightened by electricity out of 5. I give it 4 because I love this movie to death. And yeah, there's almost everything is great. I just 10-20% less screaming from Rachel. And I think we shouldn't have seen Robbie at the end. I didn't like that particular part. I'm fine with, you know, what killed the aliens and everything. That doesn't bother me, that part of the ending. Just having that tender moment.
Robbie should have died.
Robbie either should have died or we should have been... We didn't need to know, because it cheapens the whole scene with him saying goodbye to his son and everything. But maybe that's just me. This movie is pretty mean, like for a Spielberg movie. Like, it's one of Spielberg's meaner kind of movies. Like, lots of people die and all this sort of stuff happens. And I think Robbie not making it would have fit the tone a little bit better. But that's just me. How would you rate it?
I am an enthusiastic lover of this film. I'm going to give it 5 tripod alien sphincters out of 5. Because this is like in my top 3 sci-fi movies of all time. I think
this is
way up there for me, and people are often very surprised when I say that, but I just love it. Like I said, I think it's immaculately shot. It's a beautiful movie, great special effects, great Tom Cruise, wonderfully paced. It is just, when you think of like Steven Spielberg at the height of his powers and the great set pieces that he has all through his movies, this movie is just wall-to-wall set pieces, great pacing. Some of the set pieces themselves are like, you know, quieter moments, like the, you know, the really tense stuff in the basement with Harlan.
Yeah.
But even those things in and of themselves are like really memorable chunks of the movie, you know, where you're just thinking the whole time, shut the fuck up, Harlan. Shut up. I want to get out of this basement with this crazy guy. So even the quieter parts of the movie are either like really tense or haunting. A lot of really just amazing imagery. I love it. 5 buttholes.
Oh, man. Now I want to know. 4, you've picked it, Kara. I feel the exact same way. It's just there's a couple of things that annoy me in it that, bring it down a little bit. So to continue, I mean, we could talk about a million things forever, but I would like to know, apart from the ending, do you think there is anything else, apart from the ending and the fact Tom Cruise jumped on the couch when promoting this movie, do you think there's anything else that made people react so poorly to this movie? And
apparently, a piece of trivia that I just learned is that apparently Steven Spielberg was meant to also be doing the promo with Tom Cruise on the day, but he pulled out to go and like attend to some last minute effects, and that was the day that he wound up jumping on the couch.
Do we think that Steven Spielberg... No, actually, no. So have you ever watched that couch thing fairly recently?
Not that recently, but I do recall. It's
Because if you when you watch the whole thing, like, and this is when I try and explain to people who are like, oh, he jumped on the couch. I'm like, if you watch the whole thing, Tom Cruise seems like a fairly excitable man the best of times. But when he gets in there, that audience has been whipped up into such a frenzy by Oprah. They're just like screaming. Like, you can't hear anything. It's just them screaming and screaming and screaming. And Tom Cruise is obviously like, the atmosphere is really electric. So he is reacting accordingly to how else everyone else is reacting in that studio. It's not that bad when you put it that way. And also, I'm like, there's a man who loved this woman enough to be like, I love her, and jumped on the couch. Like, I think in my opinion, some of the opposition to that is because people are like, how embarrassing expressing your love for a woman, like, so visibly, like in a, you know, toxic masculine kind of way. Yeah, I think all unfair. I don't know how much Steven Spielberg would have changed that. Maybe everyone wouldn't have been whipped up into such a frenzy because Spielberg was there, because Spielberg is like a sensible kind of presence, maybe.
Or if the interview would have been less about Tom Cruise and his love life and all that sort of stuff.
That's actually true. Yeah, that's probably what it would have been.
And would have just stuck with, you know, promoting a movie. Yeah, like, I definitely think that in my recollection of it anyway, that it, like you said, it was an atmosphere of going along with it, as opposed to everyone is sitting by in awkward silence as I, like, jump up and down on the couch and screech about my girlfriend. Yeah, like you said, you can definitely attribute some of the reception to this movie to the fact that, like, this was the point of the very public turning on Tom Cruise.
Because how long after this was, like, that Scientology tape leaked? Wasn't long after, was it?
I don't think so.
I don't know if that would have affected this movie.
I don't know. Like, this is obviously wildly speculative at this point.
Oh, that's what this podcast is all about.
That's right. But yeah, like, the obviously Scientology, not good. That's fine. I don't think that's controversial to say. And, you know, he's definitely been an advocate for it and a spokesperson for it and everything. All of the things I've read about and like, seen people talking about, and not just, like, other movie stars, but, like, just people who work on film sets. The only things I've ever seen anybody say about him have been that he is, like, extremely professional, pleasant to people, and easy to get along with. Mm. I don't know if you saw that. Did you hear that audio that someone leaked recently of him, like, yelling?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Many times.
Well, and people were talking about it like it was the Christian Bale flip out thing.
Yeah, so, you know? I noticed, because I'm not on Twitter that much, everything I saw was actually super positive. Like, I understand why he reacted like that and it was justified, blah, blah, blah. And then I went on Twitter and everyone was like, Tom Cruise is a shit cunt. How dare he do that to people? He's awful, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, that's so different to, like, on Facebook and Instagram and stuff, where I saw people talking about it, where they were all like, oh, I don't normally like Tom Cruise, but I get why he reacted like that. And he's stressed out and he's trying to look after a film set and all his crew and everything. And yeah, I thought that was really wild, the difference
because he's a producer on everything that he does as well. And yeah, so like listening to that thing where the stuff that I saw portrayed it as being like the Christian Bale thing. If some fucking sound guy is in my line of sight again while I'm doing this reading, you know, I'm gonna flip out. I'm gonna go chimp mode.
Yeah.
And whereas like the Tom Cruise thing, I listened to it and it was like him saying, hey, this is really serious. We have all of these protocols and stuff in place for COVID and everything. The fact that we're like doing all of this is the only reason that we all get to have a job. And, you know, if people jeopardize that, you're going to fuck it up. We're going to shut the thing down. No one gets to have a job.
Well, there's people at home with no jobs. Like,
yeah, yeah. And just being like, you know, if you fuck it up for everybody, I will fire you was the gist of it. You know, that's kind of the worst thing I've ever heard of him doing on a film set. Every other anecdotal thing I've ever heard is this man is like the consummate professional. This guy shows up on the first day and he has memorized all of his lines from the script. He has memorized all of the lines of anybody that he is in a scene with so that he knows all of his own cues. He has memorized everything that he needs to do for the movie, like just approaches it in an extremely workmanlike fashion and everything.
Because he's the world's greatest entertainer.
He
loves his job more than anything, and he's going to do his absolute best every time.
That's right. This is the Tom Cruise propaganda podcast.
Yeah, that whole video leak thing, like, to me, it was mostly just disappointed dad energy. Like,
yeah,
he was so angry. But then by the end of it, he was kind of like, not apologetic, but he was kind of like, oh, I've overreacted a little bit. I'm going to kind of like soften it a little bit by explaining and calming as I calm down kind of thing. And also he like a day later apologized to everyone apparently and then sent them all home to have some time off over Christmas or whatever. And I imagine he made it up for them. And yeah, anything I've heard. I've got some people I know who work in composition and visual effects over in the UK, and they didn't have they've not worked on any of his movies, but they have friends who have, and he's done things like he would go into the office when all the people are doing the visual effects and everything, and they said no other actor ever does this, and came in and was like asking them about what they were doing and like really genuinely excited to check that part of the process out and talk to the staff, just random staff about it. And, you know, he takes some staff all out to see the movies at, like, they were talking about the one in Leicester Square they went and saw, and apparently there was a problem with the sound. And Tom Cruise was like, this is bullshit, and just went and hired a cinema across the way and took them all over. And, like, just, yeah, he seems like, yeah, Scientology aside, I think he seems like a really nice guy. And maybe he's a horrible person in real life, but what he presents to people and the public and everything. Like, when he went to that movie, when he went and saw Tenet, did you see that?
Yeah, it was so funny when he's just like, great to be back at the movies.
It's clapping and
like, well, yeah. the weird irony of this, of course, is I remember watching an interview. Yes, I was watching the Joe Rogan show. Sorry, everybody. Because he was interviewing Ron Miscavige, who is David Miscavige's father, David Miscavige being the current leader of Scientology. So this guy was talking about how, like, you know, obviously he feels really bad because he introduced his own family to Scientology in the 70s, and his son has wound up being the world leader of Scientology. And he was like, yep, I lost my family, and I spent all these years, like, getting my daughter out and all this kind of stuff. But what he was talking about was, he was like, in the 70s, when I started in this thing, he was like, the courses that you start off with are just like, hey, here's a course on how to be a better communicator with somebody. And it's all these things that are like, look people in the eye when you're speaking to them and make an effort to remember their name. And, you know, just a lot of that sort of stuff. Be honest and direct with people. Be polite. All that sort of stuff. And he was like, yeah, so they give you a bunch of these courses that when you use them and you follow the thing, you're like, oh, there is an actual improvement in my life from doing this thing. But then as you progress through the organization, the things start to change, and they start to require like bigger financial commitments from you, and they start to get your whole finances involved. And then once you are at the point where you are completely hooked into the thing, that's when they hit you with the it's aliens and
yeah.
all that kind of thing. Now we're going to live on a boat.
Yeah.
But I was sort of thinking about this as like, you know, Tom Cruise being, I guess, you know, I'm sure that Scientology would look at him as he's one of the sort of faces of Scientology as look what you can accomplish when you do all of the things that Scientology teaches you. And yeah, I was sort of thinking about like the stuff that that this guy's dad was saying, and like, yeah, well, apparently half of the reason that Tom Cruise does so well with everything is that like he treats all the people that he works with respect, and he looks them in the eye and he remembers their name. Like a lot of the stories that you hear are people saying like I remember seeing an interview with Russell Brand. And someone was talking to him about working with him on like Rock of Ages.
Oh yeah.
And he was like, yeah, where he's like, oh, you know, you'd sort of, he was like, yeah, it was just weird. He'd ask you how you were, and you'd say, oh, you know, my nan's not too great. And then you'd see him 2 months later and he'd be like, oh, how's your nan doing? You know, like he clearly listens very closely to things that people are saying and internalizes them and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, whatever your motivations are, you can only do those things through actual effort and application.
Like if he's a real shitty guy, like in his private life, like to put on that front to so many people all the time, doesn't that make you a good guy? I guess, like, what does he do in his home life that could, So, from all intents and purposes, he must be a good guy, unless he, I don't know, kicks puppies or something at home. Like, I don't know what he could be doing to be anything but what we see.
Well, it's a very elaborate ruse, otherwise. And like, you know, obviously, don't take any of this as any kind of great endorsement or defense of Scientology or anything, because there are a litany of, you know, documented things about all of that sort of stuff.
Scientology fucking sucks.
Yeah.
And, you know, apparently, although Ben was like, you're defending Scientology again. And I'm like, no, I'm just saying it's not the same as this cult movie we're watching. Scientology is cult-like, but it's not. Anyway, I defend Scientology a lot, but I'm not doing it because I like Scientology. I just think it gets that extra bit of unfair criticism when there are plenty of other organized religions that are just as fucked.
Well, that's true. I mean, that what's the real difference is that one was invented in the last 50 years.
It's not fucking Nixium where there's like a sex cult kind of simmering just underneath. Although maybe there is. Who knows?
Oh, man. I watched that documentary. That was wild, that Nixium thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess my point is simply that to hear it told about how, like, what the kind of some of the fundamentals of the Scientology stuff are in terms of, like, teaching you life skills, it really seems as though a big part of Tom Cruise's success has been applying those things, you know, as thoroughly and consistently as you can over a long career. And it's paid off, apparently.
Yeah, I'll criticize Scientology for a lot of things, but making Tom Cruise real good at his job, it did it.
Right.
You know, the proof
That's
is
no
in the
crime.
Pudding. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, we'll leave that there then. In summary, Tom Cruise, two thumbs up.
Two thumbs up.
Anyway, thank you again for joining me, Andrew, and talking to me for hours about this wonderful movie.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Can we just remind us where we can find you online?
Find me on the podcast Bunta Vista. I will be talking about Bigfoot scams people have done. Lots of very important and relevant news like that. Maybe finding out what some local monkeys have been up to. Very topical podcast. And you can find us at buntavista.com, on Apple Podcasts, all the places where you would get a podcast.
I've already mentioned this with Ben, but the way you guys keep shitting on Disneyland, I don't like it. And I'm personally offended by it every single time it happens. Just
look,
some
that's
feedback
fair.
From me.
I'm just very against waiting in lines.
Oh, man. So are we. We have techniques to avoid doing that. But that's for my other podcast, talking about Disneyland queues and how to avoid them. Yeah, if you want to find me online, it's Tom Cruise Reviews on Instagram, Tom Cruise Review on Twitter, no S on the end, and TomCruiseReviews.com. I'm going to go cough myself to death right now after 2 hours of talking about Tom Cruise. Thanks again for joining me, Andrew, and we'll catch you all next time.
Bye.